KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today, I'm very excited to have on the author of a new book called GLUT, Mastering Information Through the Ages. The author is Alex Wright, and whose biography I will discuss in a moment. Literally, this book does exactly what the cover says, as opposed to some titles of books, which can be abstract. What Alex does here is trace a variety of history looking at how information itself is collected and disseminated. And in fact, in his introduction, he says, and this is a quote, "In these pages, I traverse a number of topics not usually brought together in one volume. Evolutionary biology, cultural anthropology, mythology, monasticism, the history of printing, the scientific method, 18th century taxonomies, Victorian librarianship, and the early history of computers, to name a few." So this is a very, very broad history. Of course, he does note that no writer, and this is a quote, could ever hope to master all of these subjects. And indeed, the book isn't presented as a encyclopedic, thorough history of all of these areas. The connection, of course, is what we'll be discussing and what he titles his first chapter, Networks and Hierarchies, how these different elements came together over history and how they ultimately developed not only libraries, but really, again, how information was collected and disseminated. It's a fascinating history, and it continues a trend of interviews that we've done on Hearsay Culture since its inception, including the recent interview with Professor Robert Friedel from University of Maryland, who wrote A Culture of Innovation, Tracing Innovation History Itself. And we've had several other guests on the show as well who have taken different looks at how we deal with information, how we categorize them, and how ultimately the public at large today in 2008 can attempt to get a hold of everything that's out there. But this is more of a historical view, and one that is highly accessible to people that are not intimately familiar with the history, or indeed intimately familiar with what we mean by information science. And so I'm very excited to have Alex on today. Alex currently is information architect for the New York Times. He's a writer as well, of course, whose articles have appeared in Salon, Harvard Magazine, the Christian Science Monitor, The Believer, and other publications. He's done a variety of information architecture projects for not only the New York Times, but Harvard University, IBM, Yahoo. He holds an MS in Library and Information Science from Simmons College and a BA in English and American Literature from Brown University. And as we'll discuss at the end, he also has a website at alexwright.org. So without a further introduction, Alex, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks for your, as a logistical note, thanks for your flexibility as well in scheduling.
Oh, sure. No problem.
Let's jump right in. I gave a brief bio, but perhaps more on your background and ultimately leading to the question of how you got into this area and why you chose to write this book.
Sure. Yeah. So my background, I find it hard to categorize myself. Actually, I think I'm more or less a generalist. I got into this topic. I've actually been interested in the topic for quite a while. I think I first got interested in the whole topic of information and sort of systems for organizing information pretty early on in my career. My first job out of college was working as an assistant at the Harvard Library back in the late 80s, where I worked on one of the early library automation projects, where we were actually digitizing the card catalog and trying to basically migrate this huge collection of millions of index cards into this online database. We were also pretty soon thereafter looking at the evolution of electronic texts, like early CD-ROMs, and eventually online journals, and eventually, a few years into it, this thing called the web sort of popped up. And, it was very interesting working in that environment just to see how these new this sort of cascade of new technologies was emerging that was constantly sort of throwing everything into question and was creating, in a way, a lot of instability in terms of the way that this, very well-established institution was trying to grapple with its mission to organize information to support, this large body of faculty and students. students. And, I felt like, it was sort of soon thereafter that my career took a little bit of a, left turn as the web sort of took hold. I suddenly got sort of caught up in the whole, the whole internet, rush. And I pretty soon ended up taking a job at IBM. I worked there for several years, and then I moved out to California. I was part of the whole, I guess you could say, dot-com gold rush, and I worked at some startups and, worked with a number of different companies. And what was interesting to me during that period was seeing how, there was such a, everything seemed so new. There was this sort of, collective, cultural shock taking place as the web really started to take hold and start to create all kinds of disruptions and transformations and all kinds of different, companies and institutions and creating whole new economic models. And I felt like, there was this feeling that everything, it was almost like this sort of cultural amnesia seemed to be setting in, that suddenly everything was, was up for grabs, and there was this, everything, it seemed like this sort of brand new day where everything was going to be, was suddenly different. And if you read a lot of the journalism and the, a lot of the rhetoric that was sort of percolating around that time, there was this incredible wave of hype, about this new medium. And I felt like what was missing was any, from the dialogue at that point, was any sort of historical perspective. I think there was a feeling that, here's this brand new thing, and suddenly everything's just, just being reinvented all at once. And I felt like, having come from, the world of libraries and having had some perspective on, the ways that people had organized information in the years before the internet, and having some connection to the heritage of that, that I felt like there was maybe some value in going back and trying to take a look at, what's really happening here, and can we look at what's happening now as part of a, a longer historical narrative, or are we just in this sort of ahistorical moment where, new technology is just sort of, has created this blank slate? So I felt like what I wanted to do in the book is really take, take that as a starting point to really go back and look at, the heritage of how people have, dealt with information in different periods in history, and sort of looking at it through the filter of where we are today, from the present day stance of, we have this context of the internet and the web and all these new tools, but seeing if our sort of present day vantage point changes the way we read history, if we start looking back, and can we find sort of corollary periods in history where a new sort of disruptive information technology has emerged that has caused sort of sudden changes in the way people have organized information, and what are the sort of social effects of that? What are the economic effects? I mean, what are some of the lessons we can maybe learn by looking at some of these earlier periods in history and seeing if there is some sort of deeper historical pattern that may be playing out? So that was sort of where the book came from.
The title, of course, certainly I think sets the stage for many of the themes you have in the book. But literally, it sounds like an obvious question, but you title the book Glut. So why did you use that word as the title, and what do you mean in the context of the study that we're going to get into in a moment?
Well, it's funny. The title was my publisher's idea. It actually wasn't my original title for the book, but they read the book and felt like that was a better title than what I had in mind. So we ended up going. I think they also felt like, to some extent, to be honestly, book titles are to some extent, marketing decisions. And I think they felt like that was a more, it was a marketable title. There's sort of trends towards, I guess, kind of one word snappy title. So I'll be honest. I'm not 100%. Enthusiastic about the title. I mean, I'm fine with it, but it wasn't quite my idea, so I won't take credit for it.
Fair enough. And having grown up around the publishing industry, as both of my parents were in publishing, I'm very familiar with the editorial process. So fair enough. And while I'm at it, I can offer at least this compliment that I like the jacket cover.
I've actually come around. To be honest, I've come around. down to it. I didn't like it at first, but it's sort of grown on me.
So. Yeah, I like it. And so for what that's worth. But fair enough. Well, let's dive in a little bit more into the structure of the book, because I'm always interested when I speak to people that that write histories to ask a kind of a broad question. You know, as I mentioned in the introduction to the topic, you're bringing together a wide variety of areas to weave this thread regarding information management. And I guess I'll ask you this broad question. How did you choose the history to include and not to include in this book? Because after all, you're not writing an encyclopedia, and as you indicate, you're not representing it as the thorough compendium of all history relevant. So how did you go about choosing what you were going to cover and what you weren't?
Well, I mean, to be honest, at some level, it's subjective and I guess you could say a bit arbitrary. But I found that, you know, the way I sort of found my way into the topic was really just by pursuing my own thread of research. So I sort of started working my way back and just sort of charting my own trail through the literature. And I just sort of worked my way back through, you know, topics that I found interesting. And then I would sort of follow the citation threads and just sort of work my way back into, a trail of different sources. And it was a pretty organic kind of process. I mean, I didn't really start out with, I would say, a clearly defined research agenda. I mean, it was really, and I think this is maybe why this book is maybe a little different from a more traditional academic book, where, you know, I think this is the kind of book that would actually probably been very difficult to write from within the academy, because it is a very broad book that really covers a lot of different periods. And I think it's the kind of thing that it's certainly in traditional academic settings is, you know, I think a lot of people tend to shy away from. But to me, it was really just a question of following the topics that just interested me. So it was really, I felt like if I found subjects that I personally found interesting, I thought that it was more likely that I'd be able to write something interesting about them. So I didn't really start with a clear agenda. It was really just more of a thread that I started to weave, just finding my way through the literature and just sort of going off on tangents and piecing together this particular narrative that sort of made sense to me. So.
It's I'm always interested in hearing that, because that is a common theme a lot of times in histories, where people will either stumble upon something that turns out to be the focus of the book, or indeed they start with naturally what is their own interest and start finding these connections, and then suddenly realize that there's a broader history that they can get into. So certainly you weave these themes together, and I do want to ask you, because you're not a historian by training, and yet this book, I think is an excellent history. How has the book been received, to the extent that you've been able to gauge it, by historians?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'll be honest. I was a little nervous when I started really getting into some of these topics, because I realized I was starting to tread into some fairly, sometimes kind of heady academic topics, and I wanted to really be careful to, not to overstep, because, you know, as you say, I'm not a trained historian. I'm not a, credentialed, PhD, academic or anything, but I felt like, I felt like as I started to get into this, I definitely found myself wading into some topics that were really sort of had been up till that point the domain of specialists. And so when the book came out, I was waiting a little nervously to see how it would be received. And I was really pleasantly surprised when the reviews started coming in. Anne Blair, who's a historian of science at Harvard, wrote a really pretty nice review in Nature when it came out. So I was very pleasantly surprised to get reviewed in Nature in the first place.
Right, not the first place you would have thought to find the review.
Not where I would have thought. Yeah. And then it's got, reviewed several of the other reviews, Wilson Quarterly and New Scientist. And, it's gotten generally, the published reviews, I've yet to get a really bad review. I mean, some of them have gotten a couple of reviews where they've said things they liked or thought could be improved, but to the extent that it's been considered by academics, it seems to have gone over okay. So that was kind of a relief. Although I think I want to be a realist. I mean, it's not intended as an academic study. I mean, this is very much a general interest book, and it's written from my own sort of personal point of view on a number of topics that I found personally interesting. So I'm not. It's not purporting to be you know, an academic monograph, and I don't think it should be judged by those standards. Although I did try to, you know, do my homework, and I think that at least the research that I did, I think, you know, I would expect to be judged by professional standards, but it's not intended as a, you know, as, you know, I'm not trying to get tenure, I guess. You know?
Fair enough.
I just wrote about what interested me. So.
Right. Yeah. You don't carry the pressure of academic publishing.
Right.
Let's dive in a little bit specifically into the book itself, and so recognizing that, like you just said, this isn't an academic publication. I'm going to use an academic word nonetheless, and you can tell me whether it even applies. But would you say that there is a thesis in the traditional sense in this book? And if so, what is it? I see a number of threads and potential theses, but I'm curious what if you have thought in those terms, and perhaps there's another way to approach it. What would it be?
Well, it's funny. I think there is a thesis, and it's a thesis that actually really emerged from writing the book. So it's not like I necessarily had a thesis in mind when I started writing it. I was just more interested in writing a history and really going back and looking at looking for interesting stories about how people had organized information over the years. But as I got into the topic, there was a pattern that seemed to emerge, which is that, you know, there seems to be an ongoing tension in the way people have organized information over the years between two basic kind of archetypes. There's the archetype of the network, and there's the archetype of hierarchies. And those forces seem to really play off against each other in interesting ways at different points in history. And I think we can certainly see that today, where with the growth of the web, we have this very bottom-up sort of self-organizing network that is, really starting to, infiltrate, around the world, and has really, found its way into, all kinds of different, corners of industry and academe and just people's day-to-day lives. So there's this sort of emerging network that seems to be causing a lot of disruption. A lot of traditional hierarchical systems seem to be coming under a lot of pressure from that network. So if you look at what's going on in a lot of companies these days, I mean, the internet is causing all kinds of organizational change, all kinds of disruptions in the supply chain. The ways that companies interact with each other is really being renegotiated, in a lot of interesting ways. And I think that's playing out at a, even more of a macro scale in terms of the way, countries, interact. I mean, if you look at the trend towards globalization, a lot of that is really being enabled by the fact of the internet. If you look at the a lot of the trend towards outsourcing and offshore development is really coming from the fact of these internet protocols taking hold. So the fact that people can exchange data over the web using XML formats enables companies to really start to enmesh themselves with other companies in other countries in ways that are really unprecedented. And the result is that the network is really causing a lot of these relationships to be renegotiated. So that's a pattern that, it seems like a very modern phenomena that, this network is taking shape, and suddenly, a lot of old systems, old existing hierarchical institutions, like newspapers, for instance, are feeling a lot of pressure. But you can actually see a similar pattern taking shape at different points in history. So if you look, for instance, around the time the printing press emerged, you can see kind of a parallel there, where there was an existing institutional hierarchy, the Catholic Church, that had a lot of power and was very centralized and was a very top-down sort of structure. And as the printing press took shape, it actually enabled people to communicate with each other more directly. People were able to print pamphlets, post bills, to basically negotiate relationships with each other and to circumvent the traditional sort of filters of the Catholic Church. And as a result, you had the Reformation and a lot of disruption emerged from this sort of, from a technology that really enabled a more kind of networked pattern of human interaction, coming into conflict with this existing institutional hierarchy. and there, you know, previous at previous points in history, I look back and I see actually a similar sort of pattern emerging when the first technologies of writing emerged. There, you could actually see a kind of similar phenomenon playing out, where you know, the early earliest forms of writing really grew out of people starting to interact in commercial networks. People that actually, the earliest forms of writing were actually forms of counting. So the they were really, writing really emerged as a tool for people to keep better track of their commerce with each other. People were able to keep track of trades and keep inventories and make lists of things, and it was really, it enabled this sort of networked interaction that in some way facilitated the development of large cities, because people were able to start gathering and congregating in larger, more stable settlements, and the mm-hmm. technology of writing sort of emerged to support that. And as those you know, as those settlements grew, a sort of organizational hierarchy started to emerge over time. And so there was this, again, this relationship between networks and hierarchies. There's kind of a back and forth that does seem to recur over and over again in different periods of history. And I actually trace that even further back into some of the earliest the ways that early life forms actually sort of interact. There's kind of a play between networks and hierarchies, even at the level of you know, the earliest forms of organic life. There seems to be some play between networked interactions and then sort of hierarchical structures emerging out of that. So there's kind of a deep pattern that seems to play out. So that's sort of a theme that I look at throughout the book and I keep coming back to. So I'd say if there is a thesis, that's really what it comes down to, is that there is that information seems to flow through networks, and that hierarchies emerge out of those networks, and then often they are subsequently disrupted by they're further disrupted by networks that tend to create some destabilization that new hierarchies emerge out of. So if that makes sense, that's sort of, I would say, the major theme of the book.
Yeah, you know, and I think I think it does make sense, and I think that in fact some of the stories and the histories that you trace, I think, do tie that together. And what I would want to do here is start the discussion by looking at some of the areas that you focus on. And one that really jumped out at me, I want to come to the internet perhaps after the break, but to take a step back from where we are today, you discuss in several places in the book what you call the violent history of libraries. And I was aware of this history, but I was a little surprised to hear about the number of classification systems that existed prior to the modern, relatively modern, Dewey Decimal System. So perhaps for starters, what is that violent history in sum? Because it really, the connection that you make between libraries and how they focused power and economic strength over time, I think is quite fascinating.
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting. I think today we have a kind of image of libraries as these very, peaceful, restful kind of places where people, they're kind of like a retreat where people can go and, sit quietly in a lounge chair and read a novel or flip through a magazine. Maybe in an academic setting where they're more, centers of sort of serious, scholarship. But really, if you look at the history of libraries going way back, and the earliest libraries, date back, almost to the invention of writing. I mean, the earliest libraries go all the way back to ancient Sumeria. Libraries have really been, throughout history, really tightly coupled to centers of political power. And it's really no accident, I think, that that most of the great empires in history have also established great libraries at their center. Certainly, I mentioned ancient Sumeria, the Babylonians. Certainly, everyone's heard of the Library at Alexandria, and I think it's no accident that in the 19th century, the greatest library institution on earth was the British Library, and today, the largest library system in the world is the Library of Congress. So there seems to be some relationship between the size of libraries and political power, and if you think about it, going back. Certainly in ancient history, there was, in an era when really that was, there was no, for the most part, there wasn't a lot of published information. the ability to really gather and consolidate that information in one place was really a pretty potent thing. There's a story of an ancient king Ashurbanipal, I think, who sent out an envoy to forcibly confiscate every written publication in the kingdom, and that's how the library was established. It was basically through force. The library at Alexandria, a lot of people don't realize this, but we have this idea of Alexandria as this sort of centralized sort of center of learning, but the way that library grew so big was they had a standing government policy in Alexandria that every ship that came into the port would be immediately searched, and any books inside the ship would then be immediately confiscated and deposited in the library. And you know, if you look at the rise and fall of a lot of these great empires, when an empire is when a great city is at the center of one of these empires is conquered, often the library is the first thing to go. There's a story in ancient China of the first great emperor of China, Jinhua, I think. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce the name, but his first act as emperor was actually to burn the old royal library, which contained a lot of the writings of Lao Tzu, who was a librarian at one point. And he basically established a brand new imperial library, sort of in his image, kind of to consolidate power. Alexandria was burned several times, and basically as new waves of of conquerors came in and tried to take over the city, they would ransack the library until finally it was ultimately finally burned, I think, in about 700 AD, the last remnants of it, when the city was overrun by a particular caliph. So it's been and over time there's been a lot. Libraries have really been at the center of a lot of violence and a lot of political struggle. There's a great book by a guy named Matthew Battle called Library, where he talks about a lot of this in more depth. I think today I think we have one idea of what a library is, but if we really look at the history, there's a pretty deep relationship between the consolidation of information and political power that I think is an interesting dynamic to look at.
We're talking to Alex Wright, the author of the book Glut, Mastering Information Through the Ages, published by Joseph Henry Press. For those of you who listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you in order to continue its diverse programming. So yet again, I hit you up for money on Hearsay Culture, and I ask you to consider making a donation to KZSU. You have a couple of ways to do that. You can go to underwriting or email underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to the webpage for KZSU at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue listening to the diverse programming on KZSU FM Stanford. So we're continuing our discussion with Alex Wright, author of the book Glut, Mastering Information Through the Ages. Alex, before that very short break, we were talking about the history of libraries, and I want to slightly change the focus, but continue discussing libraries in particular. Obviously, today we have an enormous debate going on about the ability and ultimately the question of how much access the internet can allow and the dissemination of information that wouldn't otherwise be available easily or readily or in many places wouldn't be available at all. And you discuss in tracing the history of these libraries that many, or you can put a more accurate number on it, but yeah, quite a few libraries were private, but there were occasional efforts to make them public. And for example, you talk about Caliph al-Azizi or Aristotle, Jefferson. I'm curious to know, the relationship of these libraries to sharing knowledge with the public generally versus what you were mentioning before the break in terms of consolidating power, and really ultimately the dangers that you saw that leaders are perceived of a public library to those who were in power and attempting to maintain that power.
Yeah, well, the idea of a public library is really a pretty recent development. I mean, you mentioned there were certainly some experiments, previous eras in history where people occasionally tried to open up these collections to the public, but I think today we have this idea of the public library is what most, when we think of a library, that's what most of us think of, is a little corner, library in our neighborhood, the lending library. But really, that whole idea is maybe 100 years old. I mean, really, maybe a little more. I mean, Andrew Carnegie was certainly the big sort of patron of the public library movement around the turn of the century. But, before that, really, there weren't many examples of public libraries, and of course, until the last 100-odd years, there weren't literacy was actually fairly was largely restricted to a sort of privileged class of people anyway. But the notion of a library that's open to the public is really a fairly democratic ideal. So it's not surprising that there were sort of glimmers of that idea in Greece and in Rome. Rome did have some public libraries, but for most of the libraries that have been built certainly up until the last 100 years were really built at the behest of institutional entities like large governments or churches or monasteries or universities, and they they weren't really construed as having any particular sort of public mission. One of the people who really started to change that was a guy named Anthony Panizzi, who was the librarian of the British Library in the 19th century, a very famous librarian. And it's interesting, he was actually an Italian fellow who was a bit of a radical and had some very sort of populist ideas. And when he came into the British Library, he met with a lot of resistance because at the time, the British Library was really this resource that was really primarily patronized by the literary establishment and the sort of learned upper and upper middle classes of London. And he really came in with the idea that it should have a public mission, and he felt that the doors really needed to be opened up to sort of the common man or woman. And he actually redesigned the entire catalog to make it more accessible to people, to sort of everyday people who were, coming, or maybe had a different sort of orientation towards the world than people who were coming out of, Oxford and Cambridge and, were barristers or, literary men or what have you. And he met with a lot of resistance. He really had a famous falling out with Carlyle, who was, famous writer of the day, who really took exception to what he was trying to do and felt like Panizzi was sort of cheapening the whole enterprise of the library by turning it into this sort of outlet for sort of the mass public. And over time, I think Panizzi's vision was really vindicated, and certainly today, we think of the idea of a public library as sort of a basic pillar of our democracy. The idea of people having sort of free, ready access to knowledge seems like such a such a basic public good today. But it's a pretty new idea. And I think it's sort of tells you something about how much things have changed compared to 100-odd years ago, and what the sort of relationship between access to information and access to political power, as I was talking about earlier. There definitely seems to be a direct correlation there between having the ability to exercise power and having access to information. There definitely seems to be a correlation there.
And to further explore this particular area, you talk about, and as I mentioned, but you talk about in the book, Aristotle and Jefferson making donations of their personal libraries to larger libraries, and that seems to be the highest ideal of the growth of a modern or enlightened civilization. I think some people are familiar with this history, but I think it's worth noting. You discuss Jefferson as a forefather of information science. What did you mean by that, and what is that connection?
Well, I think it's a little understood aspect of Jefferson. I think he's obviously an incredibly accomplished guy, and I think his we tend to remember him mostly for his political accomplishments today, but he was actually, among other things, he was an incredibly prolific naturalist. He cataloged all of the, I believe, bird species, and basically every sort of plant or animal that he could get his hands on. He would actually catalog and describe them and try to fit them into sort of a taxonomy of information about the about the new world. And Jefferson was really quite fascinated by questions of classification, taxonomy. He was very interested in the question of how you organized a library. He actually developed his own particular. He had a vast personal library himself, and he developed a classification scheme that was modeled on Francis Bacon's philosophy, and he wrote about that at some length about his sort of philosophy of how information should be organized. And interestingly, when he finally actually sold his collection to his library to Congress after the first Library of Congress was actually burned down during the War of 1812, I believe. He basically offered to sell his library at a reasonable cost to the Congress, and that actually became the foundation of the current Library of Congress. And they actually still have a copy of his original catalog. Basically, that Jefferson's cataloging scheme became the foundation for the whole Library of Congress collection.
Hmm.
So he really played a pretty, among many other things, he played a pretty crucial role in this, the conceptual structure of our nation's sort of core collection of knowledge. It was, really held sway for quite a while. Eventually, obviously, the Library of Congress today has, they're using a bit of a different system now, but certainly the whole institution traces its roots directly to Jefferson's library and his particular worldview of how he thought information should be organized. So.
Let's jump forward now about 200 years, which is a pretty lengthy period of time by any measurement of a human being's life. So we're going to jump now to really the modern era. And as I read your book, you seem to initially take a skeptical approach to, and you mentioned earlier, to these kind of utopian views of internet founders and technologists, but your concluding chapter of the book seems to suggest otherwise. Where do you come down on the question of the internet as a disruptive and/or world-changing technology?
Well, I think there's no question that the internet is a profoundly important development in most of our lives, and I think it's certainly the era we're living in. I think can justifiably be compared to the Gutenberg era, or to the period where the first forms of writing were invented. I mean, I think it is that important and that significant, and that it is really fundamentally changing the way things work, the way we interact with each other. It's altering the forms and the sort of structures of human knowledge. So I think it is undoubtedly that important. I think where I was trying to inject a little bit of skepticism, I feel like there is a bit of a utopian streak in a lot of the rhetoric that you read about the internet. That this notion that it's because it's new, it's somehow necessarily a good thing. Which I think that's far from clear at this at this stage. Whether it's ultimately going to be a good thing or a bad thing. And I actually try to shy away from making those kinds of value judgments. I think it's more important just to really understand what's going on, mm-hmm. and to have sort of a full, to have a full perspective on what's going on, rather than be taking the sort of advocacy position of saying, the internet is wonderful or it's, calamitous. And I think a lot of the books that you see coming out these days, or a lot of the rhetoric you read, seems to, for some reason, people seem to feel obligated to take sides and to really either advocate for it or against it, and I try to avoid doing that. I'm really just more interested in understanding what's happening, and I feel like a useful way of getting that perspective is by looking at some earlier periods in history and seeing how things played out.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the Gutenberg era, certainly at the time, even though today we think of printing as a wonderful thing, and you had all these all these outcomes that led to the world we know it as we know it today. At the time, it caused a lot of really painful disruption. I mean, there was a period of violence, sort of intense violence that sort of swept Europe right sort of in the wake of the printing press around the Reformation. there was a, you know, there's a guy named Leonard Slane has written a great book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, where he makes a pretty interesting case for the effects of the printing press as having had a really kind of inducing a kind of a mass psychosis, where people sort of went and suddenly were presented with this very different way of understanding the world. And in the wake of that, he makes a very interesting observation that if you really look at the spread of the printing press in medieval Europe, it seems to actually go in lockstep with the spread of witch burning for some reason.
Huh.
So as this new technology took hold and sort of disrupted things, suddenly these really, you know, crazy, violent behaviors sort of emerged. And so at the same time, in the long run, I think you could certainly make the case that, you know, the printing press was maybe a good thing. But I think, you know, so coming back to the present day, you know, I think it's good to have a full perspective, and to I think history helps inform that perspective so that we can understand what's going on, which isn't to diminish its importance. I mean, I think it's certainly, you know, there's no question that what's happening is, you know, is worthy of a lot of attention, and to try to understand what's going on. But I think it's a mistake to try to paint it as necessarily a good or bad thing. I think it's too early to say, and I think it's, you know, I think we should just keep our eyes open and try to, you know, really understand what's happening.
Fair enough. But I do want to press a little bit on this, because your book makes some interesting observations, and so I'm not going to ask you to make a value judgment per se, but you do discuss early on in the book the concept of the isolated individual. Perhaps you could describe what that means and what your view is on the perceived demise of the isolated individual.
Well, yeah, I think that is one of the interesting and more compelling criticisms of the internet, is that it is leading to this connected world where, you know, we do in some sense have a lot less privacy, and a lot, even though it may, you know, look like people are sort of sitting at their computers in sort of relative, you know, physical isolation. I think that, you know, in terms of intellectually and socially, people are much more connected, and that's, and I think that the downside of that is that the whole ideal of the, you know, the sort of individual reader, you know, the individual having this sort of private space to contemplate and to develop, you know, our individual perspective, I think is somewhat threatened by the internet. And I think that really, in a way, that ideal of the isolated individual is really something that came out of the culture of the book. You know, the notion of the individual writer sort of having this communion with the individual reader, and of that being kind of a you know, a sacrosanct kind of space or relationship that was really sort of a one-to-one sort of interaction. I think now in the world of social networks, you know, where we're all connected by email and instant messaging and, you know, Facebook and MySpace and so forth, you know, we're all sort of much more, we're just interacting in very different ways that are much, you know, seem to sort of to sort of peck away at that individual space. So I think that is a legitimate concern. I think it is definitely, something's changing. Although one argument I try to make in the book is that what we may be seeing is actually kind of a return to much earlier patterns of interaction. There's a guy named linguist who's now departed, named Walter J. Ong, who made who coined the term secondary orality. And what he was trying to get at there was trying to suggest that the way people interact in electronic media has, in some ways, bears a lot more resemblance to the patterns of communication in early oral cultures, and it in some ways resembles more of the sort of early oral tribal cultures more so than more traditional patterns of, or more, you know, more recent patterns of traditional literacy. So I think that's sort of an interesting aspect of what's going on today as well. In some way, we may be witnessing kind of a reversion to earlier patterns of communication, where people are sort of coming together in almost tribal sorts of groups. And, you know, if we look at the phenomena of social networking sites, certainly there seems to be this sort of impetus towards gathering in groups and sort of showing each other who our friends are and communicating in very conversational kinds of ways, as opposed to more traditional sort of, you know, structured linear forms of writing. And I think there is a case we made that we're seeing a tension emerge between those sorts of that sort of social, sort of oral pattern of communication, and the more sort of deterministic forms of literary communication that most of us have thought of as, as the forms of literature, certainly in the last couple of centuries. So that's definitely a pattern. I think a theme that I sort of look at towards the end of the book that I think we're still trying to make sense of what that, where that tension is going to lead us. But it does seem to be, I think especially in the last few years as social networks have really taken hold, I think it's a really fascinating sort of phenomenon to look at in terms of how that's really changing the equation of how people really, interact and relate to each other.
And it ties together nicely. We're chatting with Alex Wright, the author of the book Glut, Mastering Information Through the Ages. You mentioned towards the end of your book tying these themes together, and I do want to touch on that in the remaining about 7 minutes or so that we have. You discussed the idea of treating users of the internet as consumers rather than creators. And what does that mean, and do you see that changing?
Well, it's interesting. In the second to last chapter of the book, I look at the history of early hypertext systems. So, really over the last century, there were a number of earlier attempts at developing, software tools that were something like the web, and even going surprisingly far back to the early part of the 20th century, people sort of had this idea of networking information and creating tools that people could use to interact with that information. And I think what's particularly interesting, if you look at a lot of these early efforts, especially the work of Vannevar Bush, who I think a lot of people have heard of, who wrote this famous essay called As We May Think, where he talked about this idea of a tool called the Memex that's often been pointed to as a kind of precursor of the web. Starting there, he really had this idea that that what people really needed was a tool not just to sort of consume information or to read documents, but actually a tool to really interact with those documents, to be able to not just read, but also write, to annotate, to create links between different pieces of information. And he really saw it as, he saw this as an opportunity to create kind of a two-way device that would let people at once, research and bring things, bring documents down that they could read, but also to then let the reader become more of an active participant and to actually take a role in shaping information and contributing something. And over the years that followed, several other people sort of pursued that kind of vision. A guy named Doug Engelbart, who's sort of best known today as being the inventor of the mouse, but he also did some pioneering work in hypertext systems, an early system called the online system. He developed an SRI in the 60s. And then some of the early work at Xerox PARC in the 70s, going on through the 70s and 80s, there were people like Ted Nelson, who was certainly a visionary in this area, who had a very full-fledged vision of how hypertext could work. He actually coined the term hypertext in, I think, 1965, and developed a number of, really laid out a pretty elaborate vision for how these tools could work. But the theme that unites a lot of these early efforts was this notion of a software tool that really enabled the user to be a creator and an active participant. And unfortunately, I think the way that the web has turned out, I think that's partly a function of the commercial interests that really have driven the development of web browsers today, is that the modern web browser is really designed really as a tool for consumption. It's not really there's nothing in the web browser that's really fundamentally designed to let you participate, to write, to express yourself, to really take a role in shaping what you're bringing down. Architecturally, the web browser is a client application that pulls information from a server and puts it on your desktop, but it doesn't inherently go the other way. Now, that's not to say that the way the web has turned out, of course, is there are all kinds of tools that let people express themselves, blogs and any number of other applications that have been built on the web, I think, testify to people's desire to express themselves, to participate. But I think the web browser itself, unfortunately, doesn't really support that kind of interaction. It's kind of, in some ways, it's kind of like a dumb terminal that just kind of pulls information down and puts it in front of you. Mm-hmm. So, but I think it is very interesting to look at the history of some of those early hypertext systems. I think there are a lot of really interesting, provocative ideas in those systems that suggest alternate ways of thinking about how we might interact in a networked information space and how it could be a little more of a two-way street. So I think that's certainly a topic that I find personally interesting to think about, because I think the web has become such a sort of dominant cultural fact that it's often hard for us to even imagine how it could be different. It's become so prevalent. But I think it is interesting to look at some of these early precursors of the web just to sort of provoke ideas about how things might still be different at some point.
There's been this focus, and certainly there's been some even viral videos about the fact that we and you, as you point out in the book, that we still view the internet through the lens of the printed word, with as you mentioned, with browsers, with pages and text and structure, and that obviously plays a role. And as you've just mentioned, whether we call it Web 2.0 or Web 3.0, or what Larry Lessig calls the read-write culture, we do see that change happening. And I guess, looking back in history, as you have in your book Glut, do you see those kinds of efforts? I mean, not on the same technological scale, of course, but do you see those same kinds of concerns having popped up in the past?
Well, it's interesting. I think it takes a while for a new technology to really reshape the forms of expression, and I feel like we're still at an early enough stage with the web that we are still very locked into this paper metaphor. The way web browsers work is fundamentally we have this idea of a page, right? Well, there's nothing about a computer that necessarily obligates us to think in terms of a page. It's really just an artifact of print that we have this sort of two-dimensional construct. But I think if you do look back at previous periods in history, you can see sort of similar patterns. When when the first, in ancient Rome, the predominant form of written knowledge at that point was the scroll. And if you think about it, the scroll is a very linear sort of document. You read it from sort of top to bottom. You sort of unfold it and it reads like a long document. It was only towards the end of the Roman Empire that they developed the form of what we now recognize as a book. It's a form that's sometimes called a codex, codex book, and which is a book with covers and pages that you can flip through. And it was interesting when the codex book eventually found its way, at the tail end of the Roman Empire, it found its way to up into the rest of Europe and eventually to Ireland, which up until that time had been really an illiterate populace. They were really the first people in history to learn to read from a book as we would know it today. And what was interesting is the way they really, given that sort of clean slate and this opportunity to come into contact with what was really a pretty new form of expression, they really took that opportunity and really reinvented the book. Whereas before, a book had really just been kind of a scroll that had been cut up into pages. The early Irish scribes really sort of had a field day with it, and they came up with completely new forms of expression. They basically perfected the form of the illuminated manuscript. They would start to annotate things, in the margins, add little illustrations, and then they created interesting sort of visual indexes and tools for basically and kind of facilitating, kind of random access to the pages of a book. So the idea of an index or a table of contents or what they called canon tables, which were kind of interesting sort of visual indexes to different parts of the Gospels. They basically really took this new form and they made it their own, and they really developed new forms of expression that were tailored to that particular medium. And I think we're just starting to see that happen with the web. I think we're still exploring that and trying to find ways to break out of this two-dimensional paper metaphor, mm-hmm. and starting to explore new forms of knowledge new forms of expression that could really yet take shape. But I think at some level we're still very used to the idea of a book. I mean, most of us still learn to read from books, and a lot of us are dealing with paper all the time, even though we do have web browsers. So I think that it's a very the whole paper metaphor is probably going to be with us for quite a while to come. But over time, I think we are going to start to see people really renegotiating, the forms that we could really start to explore with the web. And I think, you know, it may be a while, but I think there's an opportunity to really think about fundamentally different modes of collecting and gathering and organizing information that might look very different from what we're seeing today. But I think it's still early going yet. I think that's one thing to keep in mind too, is the web's only been around for, not even 20 years yet. And yet it's already, already more than a billion people, have surfed the web. Well, 20 years after the Gutenberg Press arrived, there were a handful of people who had ever seen a printed book. So,
right.
The pace of change is fairly, it's unprecedented, but at the same time, it's still very early going. So we'll have to see how things play out.
On that note, Alex, we've run out of time. Certainly, I invite you back on the show to continue the discussion. The author is Alex Wright. The book is Glut: Mastering Information Through the Ages, published by Joseph Henry Press. Alex, for those that want to learn more about your work, any suggestions?
Well, sure. I mean, I do have a website where I have I actually have some excerpts from the book, and I also have I published a bibliography that people might find interesting. It's kind of an annotated bibliography if people are interested in exploring any of these topics in a little more detail. It provides a few different jumping off points where you could go and explore some of these topics in a little more detail. So my website is www.alexwright.org, and then you can click the link to my book from there, and then you'll see a link to the bibliography and so forth. So that would be one place to start.
Terrific. Alex, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave. I appreciate it.
Terrific. The guest is Alex Wright, the author of the book Glut: Mastering Information Through the Ages. I'm very excited to mention that there's a number of interesting guests coming up in the remaining period in the quarter, including Nick Carr, author of the book The Big Switch, as well as Tim Holbrook, professor of intellectual property law at Loyola. At Chicago Kent. Ned Snow, also professor of intellectual property law and cyber law at University of Arkansas, and many other guests that I'm scheduling for the latter half of the summer and the fall. So if you have any suggestions, any feedback, as always, please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And, of course, at the website hearsayculture.com, you can find all of the previous shows as well as the schedule of upcoming guests and my blog. You can also get the show by RSS feed at Stanford's Center for Internet and Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, as well as through the Center for Internet Society's iTunes podcast page by searching Center for Internet Society in the podcast search engine. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today, and I look forward to hearing from you, and please stay tuned to more diverse programming here on KZSU. Have a great day.